You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Piers Morgan made his mark as a celebrity reporter in Britain at Rupert Murdoch's tabloid The Sun, and then at the age of 28, he was appointed by Mr. Murdoch to be the editor of the weekly tabloid The News of the World. He would soon go on to become the editor of another tabloid, The Daily Mirror, where he would remain for almost a decade before being fired over the publication of allegedly fake photos that depicted British soldiers abusing Iraqi prisoners. And then Mr. Morgan came to the United States, where he was a judge on the TV show America's Got Talent and the winner of Donald Trump's Celebrity Apprentice. Many were surprised when CNN announced that he would be replacing Larry King, who was retiring, in a new memoir called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, and George Clooney. Piers Morgan discusses how he's used his position as a news anchor to address the nation's most controversial issues, from gun control to gay marriage. It's published by Gallery Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Piers Morgan to our show today. Hello.
Good morning.
You're in L.A.?
I'm in L.A. Yeah. The sun is shining, as you might expect.
Well, it's kind of dreary here. You begin and end your book with a discussion of gun violence, which seems to have become the issue you're most passionate about. Do you see yourself as a crusader for stricter gun controls?
Well, look, it's not for me to crusade in America, given that I'm not American. All I'm trying to do, I think, is keep the debate going, because what is so disheartening about it in America, and so different to countries like Britain, where we just don't have a gun issue, is that you can have these appalling massacres, as we saw in Aurora with the movie theater, or Sandy Hook with an elementary school, and after a bit of chat about it for a few weeks, everything goes quiet, and Congress does nothing, and everyone gets on with their lives. Meanwhile, you have all these lives devastated and ruined on a daily basis. Now, 35 people a day are killed with guns in America compared to 35 a year in Britain. So I just want to try and bring a perspective to it, because we used to have huge gun problems in my country. And I think there are lessons to be learned, not just from Britain, but from Australia and Japan and Germany and other countries with histories of gun violence, that you can actually move on to a place where you can have some guns, but you can be a safer country.
Well, in your book's prologue, you discuss a shooting incident that took place in the Scottish town of Dunblane in 1996. And that led you to become a crusader in England when you were the editor of the Daily Mirror.
Yeah, I mean, it was a very similar story in a tragic way to Sandy Hook. It was a small elementary school in a very small place in Scotland. 16 children aged 5 years old were murdered by a gunman. And what was interesting was the reaction from Britain was very, very different to what happened here in America, in the sense that it was never a political debate. It was never, if you're pro-gun, you're conservative. If you're pro-gun control, then somehow you're left-wing or liberal, as it is here. So polarizing here, that debate. So politicians on both sides came together, and the media came together. My newspaper was one of the many that campaigned for strong gun control in the light of this. The public were almost unanimous that something had to be done. And within 18 months of that mass shooting, Britain brought in some of the toughest gun control regulation in the world. And as a result, there hasn't been a single school shooting in Britain since, not one. And we have, as I say, 35 gun murders a year compared to 35 gun murders a day in America. Now, the problem in America is much worse than just gun murder. There's a casual accident-related gun death toll as well, particularly involving children. Many more children now on a weekly basis are being killed accidentally by guns in America than even 10 years ago.
I read that there have been over 10,000 gun deaths since Newtown alone.
Right. I mean, terrifying. But also, if you add to that every year you have, say, 11,000 to 12,000 gun murders in America, but you have 18,000 gun suicides. And then you have 70,000 Americans who are hit by gunfire who don't actually die because of the wonders of modern medical surgery. 100,000 Americans are hit by gunfire a year. I mean, it's a pretty staggering statistic. It's more than every one of the other 22 richest countries in the world combined. So America has an issue with gun violence, and it's one that I, having been heavily involved in changing the culture, I guess, in Britain, and in my view, very successfully doing that, I simply want to put it out there as, look, something has to be done. I think doing nothing when 20 children are gunned to pieces in an elementary school in America, if you're going to be the world's great superpower, is not an appropriate reaction.
Well,
it's a cowardly reaction.
It's been pointed out that Sad fact is that Britain doesn't have a Bill of Rights. But on the other hand, that means it also doesn't have a Second Amendment. And you,
well, look,
and you've earned enemies from the NRA and other parts of the pro-gun lobby who see this specifically in Second Amendment terms.
Right, but the issue of the Second Amendment is a fascinating one because I've studied this in great depth. And, of course, for about 160, 70 years after the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment, it was never interpreted to mean an individual's right to bear arms. It was always interpreted to mean that you would have the right to bear arms as part of a well-regulated militia. And one of my issues with the Second Amendment is that the wording is so vague and the placement of commas so obtuse that actually you can end up with different interpretations depending on which side you talk to. And in fact, the Supreme Court a few years ago ruled that it was now going to be interpreted as meaning an individual's right to bear as many arms as they saw fit with reasonable restrictions. I don't think that's what the Founding Fathers intended. That wasn't the way it was interpreted for the vast duration of its existence, the Second Amendment. And it's a really good argument, I think, to debate the wording of the Second Amendment and perhaps amend it again, bring it forward to the modern age. You know, the Constitution was not a sacred document. It has been amended many times, and it's been amended to move with the times. And there's no doubt that when the Founding Fathers wrote it, they were thinking about people in a militia with muskets defending their local town or wherever it may be. They weren't thinking of deranged young men going to Walmart, buying an AR-15 assault rifle and going into movie theaters or elementary schools and slaughtering fellow Americans. And I think if they had been, given they were such wise men in many ways, I think they would have phrased it in a different way. And, you know, I just think that what the Supreme Court did a few years ago was effectively give many Americans in their heads a license to arm themselves to the teeth with military-style weapons, which, in my opinion, have no place in civilian hands.
Well, do you think that all guns should be banned from private ownership as it is in England? What about the argument of gun owners that they're necessary for self-defense, especially for women?
Well, I've never argued that you should ban all guns in America because I don't think it's practical. You have over 300 million firearms in circulation, and you cannot have a situation where people feel completely defenseless at home with that amount of firepower out on the streets. My argument and the debate I've tried to stimulate is very much aimed at assault rifles, military-style weapons, assault weapons generally, high-capacity magazines, which no civilian has need of. You don't need them to hunt or to sport shoot or any of those kind of things. And I think that, in fact, there's still not universal background checks. Mandatory background checks on every gun sale in America is scandalous. It works perfectly well in other countries. In Canada, if you want to buy a gun, you go through stringent gun background checks and background checks into your life or criminality or mental health issues. The fact that 40% of all guns sold in America don't have that is ridiculous. And yet you can't even get that passed in Congress because the NRA wields such extraordinary power and is so aggressive with that power, and it does it because it's being financed by the gun manufacturers, and the gun manufacturers pump millions into the NRA. So every time there's a mass shooting, the NRA come out and say, if only everybody in the movie theater or the school had been armed, then this wouldn't have happened. And that sells a whole load more guns, and it's a vicious, horrible cycle.
And what you've been saying has earned you some enemies, as I said. Wasn't there even a petition on the White House's website to get you deported?
There was.
Do you know who started it?
I do. It was a gentleman called Alex Jones. He's a very conservative, very loud radio guy. And he began this with a few of his cohorts. And they got 130,000 signatures to the official White House petition website. And that compelled the president to deliver his verdict. And his verdict, I thought, was quite ironic. He said, look, this guy is perfectly entitled under his First Amendment rights. I'm a U.S. resident. His First Amendment rights of the Constitution to comment about the Second Amendment, which of course is true. And the fact that people were trying to deport me for exercising my own constitutional rights under the First Amendment to talk about the Second Amendment was not lost on me in terms of irony. The upsetting thing for me was that in Britain, when they heard about this, a rival petition appeared on the White House website to have me kept in America. But at one stage, I was looking at Jamaica as a possible plan C.
Piers Morgan is my guest. He's written a memoir called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God, and George Clooney. And another issue that you have taken a stand on in both the book and on your show is suggested in that subtitle, gay marriage. Do you think this is one of the most important civil rights questions of our day?
Well, I just think it all comes down to equality. You know, it's very similar to the civil rights debate in the sense of you've got a large body of Americans who simply are not treated in an equal way to fellow Americans. It is ridiculous in this modern age that there's even a debate, really, that a gay couple can't have the same rights to marriage, in my opinion, as a straight couple. And it's exactly the same as you couldn't have multiracial marriages back in the 50s in many parts of America. And, you know, that was dealt with. The Civil Rights War, it's ongoing in many ways, but certainly in terms of equality, you no longer get judged on the color of your skin when it comes to the same rights as a white person when it comes to marriage and issues like that. And I feel the same way about anyone who's gay in America, is that, you know, you have 7 or 8 states now that recognize it, but there are other parts of America that continue not to recognize it and want to have one rule for straight people and one rule for gay people. I just think in a modern world, you got to move on from that.
Most of the arguments against gay marriage are religiously based, and you're a Roman Catholic. How do you reconcile your position with the official teachings of your church?
I don't agree with it, and I don't agree with a lot of what the Catholic Church continues to teach. I'm very encouraged by what I'm seeing from the new Pope, and I hope that he moves with the times. But I think there's no doubt that when I've interviewed some people, I did an interview which I talk about in the book with Kirk Cameron, who was the Growing Pains TV actor, and he went off on this almighty rant about how gay lifestyle was basically the start of the end of civilization in the world and so on. And I watched this and I thought, this is a Christian guy, somebody using his religious beliefs to peddle just pure horrible bigotry, and he doesn't even realize it. And it just, to me, the language that is used, the rhetoric, is so inappropriate when it comes to the anti-gay rights, anti-gay marriage lobby. And, you know, it's not Christian to me. So I think the Catholic Church, like I think every church in America, will move, and it will move on issues which perhaps is always steadfastly held as being correct to its teachings. And I think that in 15, 20 years, it will move, and I hope it happens sooner.
When it was announced that you were taking over Larry King's time slot, there was a lot of skepticism. Had you hosted what the Brits call a chat show before?
Yeah, I've actually, for quite a while, hosted the most watched chat show, talk shows, we call them chat shows, in Britain, and they're longer-form biographical interviews. And they've been on prime time in British television for about 4 years before I got the Larry King job. And that was one of the main reasons that I think CNN hired me. It was not to do with my ability to judge piano-playing pigs on America's Got Talent or even to impress Donald Trump with my sharp business practice. It was all to do, really, with the fact that I had this profile in America, and in Britain I was regularly interviewing over 2 or 3 hour periods world leaders, British prime ministers, to huge celebrities like Elton John and others. And I think they saw somebody who has got a long history of journalism and of interviewing people, and who feels, as I do, equally comfortable interviewing a head of state as I do a pop star. And I think that's a particular ability that you have to follow someone like Larry, who made a fantastic 25-year career out of doing exactly that.
Weren't you still bound by a contract with America's Got Talent?
Yeah.
How did you work that out?
Well, I was under contract for 2 more seasons of that show, and ironically, the man who, in the end, made the decision to job share me with CNN was Jeff Zucker, who was president of NBC at the time and is now president of CNN. So maybe he knew what was coming down the line. I don't think he did, but it was quite ironic to me that he resisted me going to CNN, and then he allowed me to do it and to basically share the jobs. But that in itself caused a few difficulties, to put it mildly. I mean, CNN is a full-time thing. The news never stops, as Wolf Blitzer never ceases to remind me. And, you know, having to juggle quite literally judging jugglers and others with doing a serious news program was very, very difficult. And it came into very sharp focus to me when I was down in Los Angeles when the Japanese earthquake and tsunami happened. And they were the only time that I had free between the two America's Got Talent judging audition shows of 3 hours each was 1 hour 15 minutes in the middle, which happened to coincide with what would be my live hour on CNN. But it didn't give me time to get to the studio and back, so I had to get CNN to erect a studio, a makeshift outdoor studio on the roof of the theater where America's Got Talent was being filmed, literally go up a spiral staircase to the roof after the first America's Got Talent audition show, do an hour of this unbelievable, dramatic, awful tragedy in Japan, and then come back down and get back into dancing Christmas trees and the rest of it. And it, to me, when I went home that night and I poured myself a drink, I can remember I was here in Los Angeles, and I just thought, I can't keep doing both jobs. It's too incompatible. I can't move from covering one of the world's worst natural disasters one minute and come and be so flippant the next, or have to try and be. And that was the moment for me when I knew I'd have to move on.
Piers Morgan began his career as a reporter for the Wimbledon News and became the youngest ever editor of Rupert Murdoch's News of the World in 1994. We will be talking about Rupert Murdoch and other matters when we return after a little break. His book is called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God, and George Clooney. It is published by Gallery Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. Stay with us for more. And we are back with Piers Morgan, who's written a memoir called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God, and George Clooney. It's published by Gallery Books, which is a division of Simon & Schuster. In this book, you talk about your personal relationship with Rupert Murdoch, and you come to his defense in regard to the phone hacking scandal. Do you believe that he was completely unaware of what was going on throughout so much of his business?
Yeah, I can quite believe that, because when I worked for him, you know, he runs such a huge global conglomerate of media interests that when I spoke to him maybe once a week, once every 2 weeks, as one of his main editors and one of his big cash cows, if you like, he would never get into the methodology of stories. He just wanted to know what we had and what was going on in Britain and so on. It was always a much more macro conversation than I think some of his critics would have people believe.
What about Rebecca Brooks? She's at the center of this phone hacking scandal. You describe her as a close friend. How long have you known her?
I've known her a long time. I mean, I worked with her at the News of the World. We've been close friends for nearly 20 years now. And she's a great lady, someone I've got a lot of time for. She's been a very loyal friend of mine. And obviously the trial has started over in Britain today with several people that I know and consider good friends. Andy Coulson being another one, who was a former newspaper editor and also worked for David Cameron, the British Prime Minister, to help get him elected. But, you know, I can't comment, obviously, on their trials or what they're going through, but I can certainly say that I'm good friends of both of them, and I wish them all the very best.
And why can't you comment on it? You have said in your book that she's under attack because as a powerful woman, she inevitably made some enemies along the way. Are you expecting her to be found not guilty in the trial?
Well, no, the reason I can't comment is that in Britain we have very strict contempt of court laws, which mean you can't comment. And it's very different in America. You have, you know, your First Amendment rights protect that, but I'm not protected by it over in Britain. So much as I would love to discuss it, now the trials have started, I think we've got to wait and see. It could take 6 months, and we'll wait and see how they play out. But I think there's going to be a few twists and turns, and I think people may be quite intrigued when it actually gets down to the reality rather than some of the mythology they've been hearing.
As a resident here, a legal resident, are you subject to British laws?
I think it's quite complicated, but certainly the reality of the modern world is anything I say to you, for example, on your show here, very quickly gets bounced through social media back to England. And certainly in England, I would be subject to their laws. So it's complicated because the modern world has become a very small world in terms of media, and you have to be very careful. You know, I know that the rules are very different in America, and you can. I'm not always surprised, actually, doing a show like I did at CNN, by the freedom that people have to comment on trials in particular and big court cases before, during, and after them, because in Britain you simply can't do that.
You worked as an editor in the British tabloid industry, first at News of the World, Murdoch's paper, and then at a paper not owned by him, the Daily Mirror. Do you think that your time working in the British tabloid industry has helped prepare you for what you do now?
Yes, because I think the cable news business is a rough, bruising, challenging, and extremely competitive business. And that's exactly what Fleet Street was like when I worked there. You're up against some very powerful media figures, some great newspapers, great journalists, and it's a daily scrap. And it feels very similar working at CNN when you're competing with Fox News or MSNBC or the main networks. Everyone is scrabbling for viewers and for ratings, and to produce compelling shows and make, you know, your show the place that people come to when important things happen. And you know, you mentioned earlier, and it's the most gratifying thing to me about working at CNN, is that when any major event happens, any big news breaks, people do turn to us in big numbers. And it's the place they come to because they trust us, as they do indeed the network that you're on. And I think that that's an important brand that we have, and we tamper with that at our peril.
Now, you were at the News of the World and then the Daily Mirror, and both of those papers have been implicated in the phone hacking scandal. While you were editor at those papers, were you at all aware of the phone hacking and the bribery of police and other sources that
turns out to have been going on? No, I mean, as I made very clear when I gave evidence to the Leveson inquiry, which was the big inquiry set up by the British Prime Minister to investigate all this, I was not aware of illegality by any of my staff. And what I've been gratified by is that 2.5 years after this scandal started, not a single journalist that ever worked for me has been arrested or charged with any criminal offence that was committed during their time at the Daily Mirror. And that's an important distinction to lay down, is that, or indeed at the News of the World when I ran that paper. You know, I like to run papers that were very tough and fearless and crusading and campaigning, but operated within the law. And I believe that the papers I ran did operate within the law. It's important. Having said that, there are many examples, not least of which the ones that we've been witnessing in the last year involving The Guardian and The New York Times and Edward Snowden, and prior to that, WikiLeaks and so on. And there was a big Members of Parliament expenses scandal in Britain, which have all been originated from illegality at some stage. And so I think this blanket idea that journalists can never break the law to carry out investigative journalism is clearly not the case. There just has to be an overwhelming public interest before you would entertain that idea.
And you say in your book that about the Leveson inquiries, that there's an absurd double standard going on with them. But it's been reported that former News of the World reporter Paul McMullen, who also gave evidence at Lord Justice Leveson's probe, has said, "My first editor, Piers Morgan, very much set the trend. He was, I want that story at all costs. I don't care what you had to do to get that story." Why would he say such a thing about you?
Well, I think he's a ludicrous pantomime figure, as we would call them. Every year we have these theatrical performances at Christmas time in Britain where you have a pantomime where actors come on stage and there's always a bad guy who gets booed and hissed, and I would park him firmly in that corner. I have very little memory of working with Mr. McMullen. His memory of what went on is deeply flawed. And I can only go on what's happened. And the police have been investigating this for nearly 3 years now, and they have found no evidence of any illegality at the Daily Mirror or News of the World in my tenure. And you know, I can keep protesting my innocence, but you can keep protesting it too much. I don't see the need to keep protesting it. I think the papers I ran were extremely good newspapers. The Daily Mirror ran great campaigns about the Iraq War, for example, trying to stop that happening.
Were you at the Mirror from 1998 to 2000?
I was at the Mirror from 1995 to 2004.
Because James Hipwell, who worked there, said that phone hacking has long been widespread at tabloids, and he admitted that he hacked the phone of the Spice Girls and other stars. Did you wonder at the time how he was getting those stories? He also said that one of the Mirror's biggest stories was a result of hacking, the affair TV presenter Ulrika Johnson had with Sven-Göran Eriksson, England's soccer coach. If you didn't think phone hacking was taking place, how did you think that your reporters were getting all these scoops?
Well, there's no evidence any phone hacking took place. So people like James Hipwell, I mean, for your listeners who won't know the complexity or detail of this, James Hipwell was a business journalist on the Daily Mirror who got jailed. And he lied and smeared many of his colleagues at the time and ended up being jailed for criminal activity, not involving phone hacking, but involving insider dealing on stock tips. So I don't think he's really in the best position to be casting any ethical or moral aspersions at any of his colleagues. And I simply repeat that this has been a huge investigation in Britain. And to date, not a single person that ever worked for me, and I must have employed over 1,000 journalists, has been arrested or charged with any alleged offence committed on the papers that I ran in the time that I ran them. You know, I can keep talking about this, but that remains a hard fact. And I believe the papers I ran operated under the law, as indeed papers should do, except in exceptional circumstances.
Well, I want to pass one other thing by you, and then we'll move on to other things. Sure. In an article in 2007 in the Daily Mail, didn't you write that you were played a phone message left by Paul McCartney on his then-wife Heather Mills' answering machine, describing it in detail and saying, and I'm quoting, "At one stage, I was played a tape of a message Paul had left for Heather on her mobile phone. It was heartbreaking. The couple had clearly had a tiff. Heather had fled to India, and Paul was pleading with her to come back. He sounded lonely, miserable, and desperate, and even sang, 'We can work it out,' into the answer phone." So where did that phone message come from? Was that obtained legally?
Well, again, I discussed all this at the Leveson Inquiry, and that particular thing that you mentioned never appeared as a story in the Daily Mirror. And I said that I was not able to discuss how I heard it or the circumstances, because to do that may lead to the identification of a source, and I'm not going to add to that. But again, I come back to the overall picture, which is people can say all sorts of stuff that I've written or said over the years, as indeed they have. But nothing has ever actually been established that involved any illegality by either me or anybody else on the papers I ran. And until or if that ever changes, I don't really feel the need to overly defend myself. You can, you know, almost be in a position where it's like, well, how long have you not been beating your wife? Well, the answer is I never beat my wife. So it's one of those ongoing debates, which I perfectly understand why people want to ask me about it. But
Pierce, I have a tape of you beating your wife.
Well, in that case, Leonard, you've got me by the short and curt, as we say. But no, I totally, as a former newspaper editor and as an ongoing journalist, I never have any problem with people asking these questions. But I do think it has to be put in the right context, which is there is a huge criminal trial that's going on in Britain right now involving a large number of journalists. Many others have been arrested and charged with offences. Many have been arrested and not charged, and later the charges have all been dropped. And I think that it's important to let justice be seen to be done and to see actually in the end what is clearly established as illegality and what is not. And I think it'll be very interesting.
My guest is Piers Morgan. His latest book is called Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God, and George Clooney. Throughout the book, you talk about a growing obsession with Twitter. Originally, weren't you opposed to it? What changed your mind?
I was vehemently opposed to Twitter. I thought that Twitter was a ridiculous thing that involved people just tweeting inconsequential parts of their boring, mundane lives. I couldn't understand why anybody with a brain was doing it. And then I was introduced to it when I joined CNN. And within about an hour, I realized immediately the fantastic potential of this tool, both as a journalistic resource tool, which I think is unparalleled, secondly, as just a great booking device. You know, I'm able to contact directly, as I have done numerous times, people like Mike Tyson or Alec Baldwin or Jessica Alba, and directly book them over Twitter without having to go through, as I'm sure you have to many times as well, the agents, managers, lawyers, and publicists.
Which all the firewalls that people who are protecting them, even though they don't want to be protected all the time.
Right. And I think that that's just good fun to be able to break down all those titles, like you say. It's also just very entertaining if you get bored on, as I do, on many plane journeys and car journeys. I think being able to comment to large amounts of people. I've got nearly 4 million followers now, and to be able to engage with your audience on an ongoing basis about issues of the day or just even about sport or other stuff, I find endlessly entertaining.
Well, sometimes it actually leads to an exchange, an angry exchange, as you recently had with Sarah Palin. What sparked that incident where she called you shambolic? I was surprised to see that she had such an extensive vocabulary.
Well, that was the moment I realized she probably didn't write it, because I don't think Sarah Palin knows what shambolic means. But I've been trying to book her for the show for quite some time. Whilst, you know, I'm quite open about this, being pretty scathing about her skills as a politician, and indeed I wouldn't agree with many of her views, but I was keen to get on the show and have a lively debate about it. And then eventually last week, for reasons that remain completely baffling to me, she posted a photograph of herself on Facebook, which had her over the dead carcass of a recently gunned down bear, still bleeding at the head. She had a huge grin on her face, and there was an assault rifle lying on the bear pointing at her, which seemed a breach of every safety rule that I've seen involving guns. But her clear message was in her own handwriting, scrawled across the picture: "Piers, I'm a bit busy at the moment." Sarah, this was her way of rejecting my offer to come on my show. I mean, it was spectacularly tasteless. It was clearly designed to make a point about guns and gun control. And yet it made the very opposite point, I would argue, to the one that she was trying to make. I've got no problem with people hunting in America. I've got a big problem with people leaving assault rifles lying on bears, pointing at themselves in a direct contravention of any gun safety rules. That haphazard, casual way that she was using her weapon, to me, said all you need to know.
Now, you have a wonderful stage at CNN, an opportunity to speak to pretty much anyone you want to other than Sarah Palin. People ask me this question, and I'm embarrassed to ask you because I hate this question. But are there some of the interviews you've done more memorable than others? What about that Charlie Sheen right after his infamous Tiger Blood episode?
Yeah, well, it was a fascinating template, really, in how to make a booking at the last moment and how you exploit it, really, I guess, to get maximum viewership. And Charlie Sheen was at the height of his mayhem in 2011. Everyone was talking about him. He was about to leave Two and a Half Men. It was that crazy period in his life. But there was huge national interest in it. And I rang him at home. I hadn't spoken to him in nearly 20 years when I last interviewed him, but he remembered the previous time we'd met, and we had a very friendly conversation. I said, "Look, Charlie, they're doing all these taped interviews, and they're editing them up, and they're making you look stupid. Come on my show tonight for 1 hour. You know, you have a one-hour show, Leonard, which is allows people.
I have a two-hour show, Piers.
A two-hour show. I beg forgiveness, and I bow to your greater power of 2 hours over my one. But my point to him was, look, you've got a long time in an hour to have your say in a way that won't be edited. We can do it live. And all I ask is that you turn up." And he said, "Okay, let's do it." And he said, "I promise I'll be there." And with 5 minutes to airtime, there was no sign of him. And I was panicking beyond belief. And then this Maybach car swept into the CNN bureau up here in Los Angeles. And out got this rat bag, weird entourage. And in the middle of it was Charlie Sheen smoking a cigarette with a big grin saying, "Okay, let's go rock and roll." And that's exactly what he did for a compelling hour of extraordinary television. And I was able to put one tweet out to I had about 2 million followers at the time. And it was at 5:55, and it simply said, "Change the schedule, Charlie Sheen, live for the hour, anything could happen." And when we got the ratings back the next day, we could see that in that five-minute period between that one tweet, the only way we could promote this, and the start of the show at 6, 500,000 more people tuned in. So it literally went crazy on social media. And, of course, the tweet was completely free marketing. And that showed me the power of social media. If you use it at the right time in the right way, you can really drive huge audience to your show. And that's not to be sniffed at.
Now, we have very little time left, but you've written this book in a diary format. Do you keep a diary?
I do. I actually write a weekly diary column for a British newspaper. I have done for 10 years. And I like to, you know, I've done volumes of diaries as books before in Britain on my newspaper years and then coming to America and working on America's Got Talent. And this one is focused on the CNN period. I think anyone that, you know, watches the show Newsroom, the Jeff Daniels and Aaron Sorkin show, it's real life newsroom. It's what goes on behind the scenes. It covers all the big stories I've covered, from the death of Osama bin Laden, the Arab Spring uprisings, to the financial crises, to the mass shootings. It's not all one pace or one issue. It's a range of issues. And it's also the story, I think, of somebody who got an amazing job offer, you know, to replace the great Larry King and to come as a British guy and to face all the, I guess, preconceived notions of, why are we letting this British guy replace the great Larry King? Well, it's all there. And I think I have endured and suffered the slings and arrows of outrageous good fortune and misfortune along the way. I'm pretty open and honest about the good and the not-so-good times. And I think For me, it's been a fascinating ride, and I hope the people that read the book share that fascination.
And the book is Shooting Straight, Guns, Gays, God, and George Clooney. We never got to George Clooney, but people will just have to read the book to find out about that. It's published
by Gallery Books,
which is a division of Simon & Schuster. Pierce, thank you so much for being on our show.
It's been my real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.